Morning, everyone.
Morning.
I always feel like I'm coming home when I come here to see you. So, quick update on Llanelli. We tend to have between 9 and 13 people attending regularly. There's another group who don't come regularly, but come along now and again. There's probably about 19 people coming in there. And the soup kitchen is up to 31 guests, Gary likes to call them, coming along. There's a lot of problems caused by the new universal credit that officially people can't get any money for 6 weeks till they claim it. But the real figure is more like 12 weeks before they get anything. So you do get people coming in who are really desperate. And they send them away loaded down with buns and cans of soup and stuff. Try and keep them going. Is it getting worse? Well, I think it is. Because we're seeing the numbers go up. The Aylim Church in town runs the food bank, and they see lots and lots of people coming along. So, yeah, there is a problem out there.
I think we're finding this with Stoke Park. We see more and more every year.
And they've only been rolling universal credit out in a few areas, and they're about to go countrywide. So I think you're going to see big problems countrywide. Unless they can sort their administrative problems out. Then there's other people with, say, substance abuse problems who come along to the soup kitchen. Others are living in tents, on open ground in the town. So usually Gary goes with them to the, there's a place called The Hub, where they've concentrated all the help for people who need help in the town. Usually they can get accommodation fairly quickly. So get them out of the tent into a flat. So I think we are doing quite a bit of good there. The way it's growing, most of the people who come to the service have a desire to serve and help with the soup kitchen. And it's just growing by word of mouth. We haven't leafleted anyone. We haven't taken any ads out in the paper. It's just growing organically. So I think Christ has people in all walks of life. I'm meeting a different segment of society than you normally meet coming to church. So it is helpful, it's eye-opening. It's a weird writing as well. But on a personal level, I've been doing a course on cyber security run by an American technical university. The very last module was on ransomware, and I took that module on the Thursday, and on the Friday, the NHS was hit by ransomware. I won't say who I blame for that, but I don't particularly blame the NHS because they have a lot of equipment with Windows embedded as the operating system, and you can't just whip Windows out and shove Windows 10 in if you've got some kind of radiation machine or whatever, because it'll have its own particular interfaces into Windows, so very difficult. Our latest aircraft carrier is running on Windows XP, in case anyone didn't realise. It's all very dated. Anyway, time for the sermon now. Well, every day I get via my email a newsletter. It's from an outfit called the Biblical Archaeological Review. And in it are several synopses of articles concerning the latest archaeological discoveries from the Middle East as they pertain to the Bible. And if an article sparks anyone's interest, you can then click on the link and it takes you to the Bar website, where you can continue to read the article in much greater depth. Well, I remember one occasion I was reading about Mount Sinai when the article quoted an archaeologist whose statement left me feeling speechless. And this is what I read, quote, "There is no archaeological evidence for the Exodus at Mount Sinai. Therefore, the Exodus did not take place. And therefore, the Bible isn't true. And you can ignore it." Well, I mean, talk about throwing logic out of the window. Now, clearly in a rush to discredit the Bible, some people will rush in making unsubstantiated, outrageous and illogical statements just so they can attempt to undermine people's faith in God's word. I'm sure you would agree with me that simple logic would suggest that if the evidence isn't found at the traditional site of Mount Sinai, that then it has to be somewhere else. So our question for today then is, if the traditional site is wrong, where then is the true location of the real Mount Sinai? As I researched this sermon, I quickly realised that this subject's not without passionate conflict. Differences of opinion, of course, scholars and laymen alike, to be completely unyielding in their views on the subject. You know, and at times the evidence which supports some unyielding opinions is questionable, in some cases very questionable indeed. Now, scores of books and hundreds of articles have been devoted through the years to determining the location of the biblical Mount Sinai and the route taken to its slopes. One decades-old source says, quote, "Mount Sinai has been identified in 13 different locations, the Red Sea crossing in 9 places, and Kadesh Barnea in 8 places." A few decades ago, you could say other scholars have determined over 20 possible locations for the Mountain of God. End of quote. That book was written decades ago and it's well out of date. As of today, the count of candidate locations is up to 35 different places proposed for the mountain. These range from the mid-Sinai Peninsula up through the Negev Desert and across into Saudi Arabia. So with 35 candidates on the table, we have to ask ourselves, just where is the real Mount Sinai? Now, as I said, for centuries, scholars, explorers and pilgrims have sought the location of the real Mount Sinai, the mountain of God, from the biblical story of Moses and the Exodus. You know, today most people are unaware that little or no evidence has surfaced that supports the traditional site called Mount Sinai. And that's located, as you know, in the south-central Sinai Peninsula. So I think before we start looking, we've got to ask ourselves, how was it that the traditional site got its reputation? In fact, it seems the only reason that the traditional site is designated Mount Sinai is that Helena, mother of Constantine I, decreed it as such in the 300s AD. And after Constantine decreed Christianity to be accepted as a tolerated religion within the Roman Empire, his mother went around the Holy Land region, selecting physical and geographical locations of notable biblical events. Now, Helena actually didn't have a clue as to any of the authentic biblical sites. And as for the location of Mount Sinai, Helena depended on information from whoever was at hand. You know, in a land nearly devoid of Christians and Jews for 300 years after the time of Jesus Christ. She noted the locations of various and dubious shrines purporting to have been constructed at authentic biblical locations. And adding to Helena's confusion, there were competing duplicate shrines from which to choose. Quite often, according to some sources, she would rely on her dreams in coming to a decision. So, for the most significant locations of important biblical events, Helena's choices have turned out to be so very wrong. Early in the 3rd century AD, the rise of the Christian monastic movement found Christian ascetics going into the desert, the Sinai Peninsula, from Egypt to get alone with God. You know, they made it, in a sense, an exodus out of Egypt into the Holy Land. And they read the biblical text with an allegorical approach, and they saw symbols and images of things everywhere. And then they looked round at the large, impressive mountain of Jebel Musa, Katerina, and concluded that this was the site of Mount Sinai. Therefore, by the 4th century AD, pilgrimages to this mountain became commonplace. Also in this era, Helena, the mother of the Emperor Constantine, received authority from her son to confirm a location for the holy mountain in this area. Then later on in the 6th century AD, the monastery at St. Catherine was built by the Emperor Justinian, giving the area the stamp of imperial authority. You know, there's always a possibility that Helena guessed the site correctly. But what does archaeology say? Thorough archaeological explorations at Jebel Musa, Serbal Catherine, and most of the Sinai Peninsula have not revealed any archaeological remains that might date back to the period of the Exodus. Except for a few Stone Age sites, Egyptian watchtowers and mining interests, the finds from this area date back to the Roman Byzantine era and to the Middle Ages. In the late 1960s and 1970s, when Israel controlled the Sinai Peninsula, especially in the period shortly before it was returned to Egypt, the peninsula was explored systematically, intensively, by archaeologists. What they found from the era of Moses and Israel's exodus from Egypt was an archaeological blank, save for Egyptian mining sites at Serabit al-Kadem and Timna, which is near Eilat. There was no evidence of settled occupation. This proved true even at the site generally identified as with Kadesh Barnea. That's Ein Kudarat. It was not occupied until the 10th century BC at the earliest, and its fortress was constructed only in the 9th century BC. On the other hand, recent surveys of Midian have produced surprising discoveries of a developed civilization in precisely the period in question, the end of the Late Bronze Age and the beginning of the Iron Age. At Kiria, archaeologists discovered a major fortified citadel, a walled village with extensive irrigation works. Characteristic pottery is called Midianite ware, and in Saudi journals it's called Hajaz ware. Or Hejaz, rather. Well, you find this pottery all over northwestern Saudi Arabia. In fact, you find it radiating up even up into southern Transjordan in sites near Eilat. But extraordinarily enough, It's absent from Sinai. So in short, we have a blank Sinai and a thriving culture in Midian in this era. So archaeologically, it looks like the traditional Sinai has nothing going for it. However, as stated before, several other proposed sites for the real Mount Sinai have been suggested over the years. So I'll just run through a few of them. Some believe Serabit al-Qadim in west-central Sinai is the proven location because there's a lot of rich artwork there and other remains found there. Others believe it's Har Karkom in the Negev Desert, just northwest of Eilat. And here too there's an abundance of rock art, inscriptions and stone monuments. Well, another prominent proposal is Jebel Sin Bisha, which is about 40 miles southeast of Suez. Geographer and Jewish scholar Menshe Har-El favours this rather diminutive mountain. Har-El believes this location is likely because there are circular mounds of stones at the base. And the location of Bisha fits Pharaoh's request to Moses for a 3-day journey into the wilderness. In northeast Sinai, Jebel Halal is supported by Clive Jarvis as the site of Mount Sinai. Further away from the traditional site, Clark Beek and A. Lucas place Mount Sinai at Jebel Bagir, just northeast of Aqaba, at the Gulf of Aqaba's northern tip. And Nielsen puts Mount Sinai at Petra, in southern Jordan, east of the Jordan Rift. Well, my comment on all this is, what a mess. What a mess. You know, I'm always reminded of the Laurel and Hardy films of years ago. You know, they've both ended up in a real pickle. And every time Oliver says to Stanley, sort of waving his tie there, well, Stanley, this is another fine mess you've landed us in again. And poor Stanley's looking there like a dumb sheep. So we have to ask ourselves, is there a way of getting out of the mess? Well, it's my viewpoint, and I trust it's shared by you all, that the Bible record is the most important source to determine the whereabouts of the Holy Mountain. I think many of these proposed sites do not accord with the narrative and descriptions we find in the Bible. It's my belief, therefore, that we must look to Scripture to help us discover the general location for the real Mount Sinai and then narrow it down from there. But first, I just want to make this point. You can go on the web and find sources that both agree and disagree with the rest of what I'm about to say. I did say it's a contentious subject, and if anyone here has an entrenched view that favours any particular site, particularly the traditional site, I'm not trying to offend you. I've only ever discussed this topic with Brian, and that was quite briefly, many weeks ago. I started looking into this. So, as I say, I don't know what your view might be. As I say, I'm not trying to trample over anyone's long-held beliefs. So, having said that, let's make a start. Let's go to Exodus 2:15. Exodus 2:15. After killing an Egyptian, Moses fled Egypt for safer ground. When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian. Now, Egypt and its holdings would not have been safe for Moses under any circumstances. He would not have fled to the Sinai Peninsula, where archaeology shows Pharaoh had multiple mining interests, military outposts and watchtowers. Bible is clear that Moses went clear out of Egypt to the land of Midian, which is east of the Gulf of Aqaba, in what is present-day northwest Saudi Arabia. Let's just flick over to Exodus 3:1. That plainly identifies Mount Horeb, Sinai, as being in Midian. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. So scripture reveals here that Moses was a shepherd in the region of Midian. Second, the traditional site for Mount Sinai in the Sinai Peninsula has nothing to do geographically with the back of a desert. By contrast, certain mountains in Saudi Arabia are on the far side or margin of a vast desert in ancient Midian. Now, the Bible also makes several references to Moses returning to Egypt from Midian. Let's go over to Exodus 4:19. Exodus 4:19. Here we read, "Now the Lord had said to Moses in Midian, 'Go back to Egypt, for all the men who wanted to kill you are dead.' And once Israel was freed, where was Moses to lead them? To a different place? No, back to the same place where Moses saw the burning bush, to the same mountain at the back end of a desert in Midian." Exodus 3:12. "And he said, 'Certainly I will be with you, and this shall be a token unto you, that I have sent you. When you have brought forth the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God upon this mountain.'" In the New Testament, Paul wrote in Galatians 4:25, "Now Hagar stands for Mount Sinai in Arabia." So if you remember back to the story, Hagar gave birth to Ishmael, who gave rise to the Arabs who lived in Saudi Arabia. Okay, so that's the connection. You know, Paul's understanding of Arabia would be have been the one consistent with Old Testament passages. I'll just rattle these off. 1 Kings 10:15. 2 Chronicles 9:14, Isaiah 21:13, Jeremiah 25:24, and Ezekiel 27:21, which Arabia is clearly identified with the region east of the Gulf of Aqaba, where kings ruled and the Dedanites co-dwelt with other nomadic peoples. So let's narrow things down. We're looking to Midian, today's northwest and south Saudi Arabia. And can we narrow things down further? In the northwestern corner of today's Saudi Arabia sits a mountain that perfectly fits the biblical description of Mount Sinai. You know, and if Constantine's mother could have availed herself of the information in the Bible, Helena would have been able to pick a location for Mount Sinai that at least was within ancient Midian. Now there is a mountain within what was once ancient Midian that today Saudi Arabians call Jebel al-Lawz. The local Saudis enthusiastically acknowledge that Jebel al-Lawz is definitely the location of biblical Mount Sinai. You know, I'll give you a quote here. "Jebel al-Lawz, Mount of Almonds in Saudi Arabia, is significant because the mountain and its environs fit the description of the scriptural Mount Sinai and Horeb better than any other candidates for the honour. I believe that upon objective reflection on this, we will conclude that Jebel al-Lawz is one of the best, if not the best, candidate for the Mountain of Moses." I picked that quote up from someone who did a PhD, 250-page PhD paper just on this very subject. You know, and furthermore, The physical description of the mountain and the area surrounding it conform to the biblical description perfectly. Now, that mountain in today's northwestern Saudi Arabia is a non-volcanic mountain which has a blackened top. The mountain appears to have been burnt with fire all over its topmost 25%, which perfectly fits the biblical description. Go over to Exodus 19 and verse 18. Exodus 19, verse 18. And Mount Sinai was altogether on a smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and the smoke thereof ascended as the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mount quaked greatly. Now, the upper 200 feet of Jebel al-Lawz is burned black. Now, the Saudi government will confiscate any photographs of the mountain, will not allow tourists into the country. But US government satellite photos, a few private photos smuggled out of the country, reveal the secret mountain by its unique blackened peak. And the area immediately surrounding the mountain has enough level plains to provide space for the encampment of up to 2 million people, which is what the Bible indicates. You know, unlike the traditional site, there are thousands of acres in which to encamp at the base of the mountain. And also the base is clearly visible from the mountain top. Plus, the mountain in Saudi Arabia has archaeological artifacts conforming to biblical descriptions. For example, 12 impressively large, obviously man-made stone pillars, extremely ancient petroglyphs, which are drawings in the stones. And the base of the mountain is even delineated by boundary pillars and stone heaps that stand there to this day. If you remember, when God was about to descend upon the mountain, God told Moses to set a boundary so the people wouldn't trespass on the mountain and be slain. Well, are there any other identifying features? Well, near the top of the mountain, there's a huge cleft. Let's go over to Exodus 33:21. Exodus 33:21. If you remember the story, Moses asked if he could see God, and God said, "Man can't look on my face and live, he'll die. So what I'll do, I'll hide you in a cleft in the rock and cover your eyes with my hand as I pass by." Exodus 33:21. And the Lord said, "Behold, there is a place by me, and thou shalt stand upon a rock. And it shall come to pass, while my glory passes by, that I will put you in a cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand while I pass by." Additionally, the plain below has many burnt trees that have been turned to charcoal. This is because fire often leaps from the ground and sets fire to them. Well, you know, scoffers and skeptics have complained that there wouldn't be enough fuel for the campfires for the escaped Israelites. Well, judging by the burning bush episode, it would appear these sorts of tree fires have been common in the area for over 3,500 years. There was ample charcoal fuel for the Israelites to gather. And if you think back to the incident with the burning bush, it wasn't remarkable that there was a bush burning there. What was remarkable was that the flames didn't go out, so it was a common sight. And what about water supply? Let's go over to Psalm 78:15. Psalm 78:15. He clave the rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink as out of the great depths. He brought streams also out of the rock and caused waters to run down like rivers. Well, on the western or backside of the mountain is Rephidim, where Moses and the children of Israel first encamped before reaching Mount Sinai. It was here that Moses struck a rock, which gushed forth large quantities of water. Well, today a giant 60-foot rock is visible on a 300-foot tall hill to the west of Jebel al-Lawz. This rock has obvious signs of massive water erosion, but it's located in a desert region. In fact, the fissure in the rock is so large you can actually walk through it. And there's a square 20-foot altar present at this site. But what about the water supply at Sinai itself? You may or may not, in my case not, have noticed there are no accounts of Moses striking rocks for water at Mount Sinai itself. Let's have a go over to Deuteronomy 9:21, where we find there was a brook or stream flowing down from the mountain. And I took your sinful, the calf which you made, and burned it with fire and crushed it, grinding it into very small until it was fine dust. And I threw its dust into the brook that came down from the mountain. The Hebrew word for brook is nachal. It can mean a stream, a winter torrent, or a river. And you'll also find the same account in Exodus 32:20. And what's been discovered at Jebel al-Lawz is a wadi from which water channels were constructed to distribute water and gather into a lake 7 metres deep. Also alongside the lake, wells dug into the surrounding rock. These were double-lined wells, which were probably used to filter the water from the lake. Well, how many channels are visible there today? Well, some sources have identified 12 channels. You know, the area we're looking at is geologically active and is subject to earthquakes. Go over to Numbers 16:31. Remember, this was an account of Korah's rebellion, where he tries to seize control from Moses. So God had Korah and all his followers gather in one spot. Numbers 16:31. As he finished speaking all these words, the ground that was under them split open, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up and their households, and all the men who belonged to Korah with their possessions. And they and all that belonged with them went down alive to Sheol, and the earth closed over them and perished, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. Well, we look at all this, and the supposed misidentified Mount Sinai in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula possesses absolutely none of these features. The mountain in Sinai in Egypt is not in ancient Midian. It does not have a blackened top. It does not have enough level plain surrounding it to permit the encampment of 2,000 people, much less 2 million. And it doesn't reveal any 3,500-year-old archaeological artefacts of any kind whatsoever. So I think the Jebel al-Lawz site is a site worthy of much deeper investigation to prove whether indeed it is the site we've been seeking. However, the site is now a closed military area. There are anti-missile batteries located in the area. The entire plain has been fenced off. In fact, that happened as soon as interest was being shown in the Western media about this site. Quick, fence it off. And, you know, access to outside archaeologists is completely denied. In fact, any outside visitors are forbidden. So all we have to go on are photographs and artefacts that were kind of clandestinely obtained in the 1980s by the very few visitors who managed to reach the area. I remember reading about one chap, he went into Saudi Arabia illegally, across the Gulf of Aqaba in a boat, landed, was trying to get to Jebel al-Lawz, and the Saudis arrested him. And he was Jewish archaeologist, so accused him of being an Israeli spy. And they were about to shoot him till he started showing them various artifacts. And they realised, yes, he was an archaeologist, not a spy. And another couple pretended to be going off for a picnic. They were actually working in Saudi, except they were going to Jebel al-Lawz on the quiet to get photographs and artifacts. So again, I ask the question, can one prove absolutely that this site was indeed the biblical mountain? At present, it's doubtful that we can prove it absolutely. The Saudi government would have to allow a team of outside archaeologists and scientists to examine the site to include a broader mix of opinion. At present, only a few Saudi archaeologists have been allowed access, and they've published a paper ridiculing the mountain as the true site for Sinai. They concluded, what a surprise, that the site could not possibly be the true Mount Sinai. Notably in their report, they omitted many structures that previous visitors had found, or stated that they couldn't find structures that others had found. They tried to attribute everything to Bedouin. Were they subject to political pressure to reach the conclusion that they did? Were they leaned on? Well, they do have a track record of tampering with evidence to make it conform to Islamic history. So I'll leave it up to you to decide. In doing that, I'll just ask, why do you think the area has been closed off since the late 80s? I suspect it's simply not in the Saudis' political interest to admit the presence of 2 million Israelites in their country so long ago. They try and maintain that Israel is a Western intrusion. It's a Western creation. They're suddenly finding evidence that there were 2 million Israelites so long ago in their country. It would shut down their stance straight away. So in conclusion, in my view, the best candidate to date, out of all the 35 contenders for the real authentic Mount Sinai, is in northwestern Saudi Arabia, in the land of ancient Midian, and is called Jebel al-Lawz. So yes, there was an exodus, and there is a candidate site that perfectly fits the descriptions we find in the Bible. And yes, we can have confidence and we can trust what the Bible tells us about the Exodus.